she was gonna keep. Oh yeah, alright, take it easy baby, make it last all night. She was an American girl.
This is Deborah Craddock, a podcast where we sit down with everyday Americans and hear their extraordinary stories. I'm your host, Deborah Drucker. Come along with me as we discuss those things that we were always told not to talk about: politics, religion, and more. I promise you'll be inspired and have your mind opened by the end of this episode.
Well, it was kind of cold that night. She stood alone on the balcony. Yeah, she could hear the cars roll by out on 441, like waves crashing on the beach.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Deborah Craddock. Today, we will be getting to know Lisa Kahn. Lisa works at the intersection of tech, politics, and community building. In 2012, she was an organizer on Barack Obama's re-election campaign. Lisa has worked in the MIT Media Lab and has worked for Facebook. She was profiled as one of Forbes magazine's 30 leaders under the age of 30. Now she's the CEO and co-founder of Gather Round, a video conferencing platform. Lisa is a new mother who lives in LA with her daughter, her husband, and their dog, Henry. Let's dig in and find out what has made Lisa the accomplished dynamo that she is today. Hey there, Lisa.
Hello.
How you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm a little tired, but I'm doing well.
Well, new mom and all. How's your daughter doing?
Oh, she's a dream. She's so great. She's so funny.
Well, let's start with you and how you became the phenomenal person that you are and that I know. You live in LA now, but where are you originally from?
I was born in Los Angeles. I was born at Cedars-Sinai, which is also where I gave birth to my daughter, which is so beautiful. And when I was 2 or 3 years old, we moved to Laguna Beach, where I grew up.
And who did you grow up with there in Laguna Beach?
My mom and my dad. And I have 3 older brothers. 2 are much older, so we're only around on weekends and summers. And 1 is 2 years older. And we had a rotating cast of pets, a variety of dogs and birds. And those are really the only 2. My dad doesn't like cats. So dogs and birds were our options.
And what was your home life like there?
Oh, growing up in Laguna Beach in the 90s was amazing. It makes me sad that I don't think any place will ever be quite like that. It was beautiful. It was small. It was creative. I have the best parents. And beyond my own parents, the sort of community of people in Laguna Beach also helped raise me. I didn't own socks until I went to college. I would walk around barefoot. We were in the sun. There was art everywhere, music, books. I loved the library. It was just a very, very, very special, unique, beautiful place to live, and a time that was also really special and unique.
And just to interject, for those of you out there, Lisa is not the first from her family to be on Deborah Craddock. Last season, we interviewed her father, Howard Kahn. So check it out. It's an amazing interview from a fascinating man. Okay, to get back to Lisa, being that you are this American girl, how many generations back do you think that lineage goes on either parent's side?
Well, I learned about this from your interview with my dad, that his family came to America at the end of the 1800s, at the beginning of the 1900s. And my mom's family was a little bit more recent. I think my mom's upbringing felt a little bit more like the child of immigrants, just the way that they lived their lives. Whereas my dad's upbringing felt very rooted in America and rooted in Virginia, where he grew up.
And were politics discussed, or did politics play any role in your home when growing up?
Politics played a very big role in my life growing up, or at least what I now think of as politics. I always think about sort of the 3 P's of politics. Politics, which often is the game that's played in elections and who wins and who loses. Policy, which are the issues that actually impact people. And then people, which are the humans that we vote on to represent us. And I think growing up, there was less of a discussion about the sort of lowercase p politics, the game, who's winning, who's losing, which is in some ways today more like sports games. But there was a lot of discussion about the people and the policies. We thought a lot about community and making the world better and helping people. And it wasn't until I was in college that I recognized that politics, capital P and lowercase p, could be such a great vehicle for making the world better and enabling people.
And when you got to college, and which college was that?
I went to NYU.
And when you arrived at college, were you already a politically minded person?
No, I started college in 2006. And this was right around the time that Barack Obama was starting to run. And in the fall, I think it was the fall of 2007, one of my college roommates, who was a very sophisticated woman from Brooklyn, whose mom worked at Legal Aid and is now a federal judge, she, for her birthday, wanted to go to Washington Square Park to see this guy with the funny name speak. And his name was Barack Obama, and he was running for president, and I had really not heard of him. But I've always been a good student, and so I was about to see this person speak, and so I had to do my homework. And I remember going to the library and watching tons of interviews of his and reading. I checked out one of his books from the library and read that because I was so curious who we were about to go see. And that was certainly my political awakening. I registered to vote for the first time while there, and I remember the woman had a clipboard who was registering me to vote, and she was smoking a cigarette. She's like, oh, do you want to register to vote? And I was like, no, I don't really have time. And she said, I'll make you a bet. You'll finish filling out this form before I'm finished with my cigarette. What do you say? And I said, okay. It was a great tactic. And watching Barack Obama speak in the fall of 2007 was so incredible. And I was surrounded by so much diversity. And what was so motivating to me about his words were the way that he kind of put it back on us. It was such a community-driven approach to politics. It wasn't about him and him saving the day the way that, you know, Donald Trump sometimes speaks, but it was about us and him enabling us and our ability to impact our neighborhoods and our communities and our states and our nation. And I started volunteering for him then, and then eventually joined, when I graduated college, his campaign full-time in Florida.
And when growing up, going back to that, what political party was your family most affiliated with?
Yeah, I think politics were so much less divisive then. My dad was a Democrat, and my mom was very progressive, but I'm pretty sure she was a Republican. She sort of had progressive values, just didn't want to pay as much in taxes, is sort of how I remember it growing up. And I think that her parents were also Republican, and it was sort of okay then that my dad was a Democrat and my mom was a little bit more Republican, although I think she would deny that she was a Republican in the 90s.
I know a few people denying that these days.
Yeah.
I wanted to also ask you then, was there religion in the house?
Yes. We grew up Jewish. Both my parents are Jewish. And in Laguna, there weren't a lot of Jews. And so my mom made me feel very special for being a Jew. And she would come to Top of the World, where I went to elementary school, around Christmas time, and she would bring the dreidel and tell the story of the Maccabees and sort of make Hanukkah feel better and more fun than Christmas. And we would always do the High Holidays. So we very much grew up Jewish. I think my mom had a series of experiences prior to me being born that led her to believe that it's important for kids to be raised with some religion. She had some experiences kind of studying, is maybe one word for it, cults. She studied a cult in India, and she found that a lot of the people that were there were not raised in any sort of religion. And so they were a bit lost in their adulthood and more susceptible to kind of more extreme viewpoints. And so it was important to her that we grow up with the structure of religion. And I was very much raised with the sort of stories of Judaism and the traditions of Judaism.
So she found that people who do not have some sort of faith or religion in their lives might be more likely to join a cult, an extremist organization, or perhaps a gang.
Yeah, and I found very similar things throughout sort of my career. My lens for it is a little bit different in that when you look at the last 70 years or so, there's been this massive decline in people's membership to community, whether that's a religious community or a political community or a local kind of community group within your town. people just aren't part of communities anymore. And we as human beings need to be part of groups to feel like we belong. It's one of our core needs as human beings. And so I've studied a lot in my adult life, political extremism, and have certainly found that there is a real connection between people's lack of membership to community, one very common one being religious communities, and people's likelihood of finding belonging in a really extremist community, which might be, in our world, an extremist political community or a variety of other more dangerous things.
And being that you are so involved with technology and present day technology,
yeah,
do you feel that some of this technology has in fact detached us from our community?
Definitely. There's good and there's bad. Certainly technology has also made us closer together. When I was at Facebook, I worked on the Facebook Groups product, which I think were a really interesting example of the best and worst of technology, because Facebook Groups were these amazing kind of forums for people to find people who were like them. There were examples at Facebook where people who had a really rare disease formed a Facebook group and found each other and then petitioned drug manufacturers to make them a drug. Whereas prior to that, there weren't enough people who would be able to do the clinical testing. These really amazing stories. But then on the other extreme, Facebook groups also brought together people into very toxic and very, very dangerous echo chambers, where people came together with a shared identity, much like they did, you know, with the disease groups, for instance. But that identity was very hateful, and a lot of misinformation and divisive content was shared, which, of course, we exist in a world that isn't just online, but also started to contribute to some kind of real world harm and real world hate.
Being at Facebook and seeing these hate groups and these radical organizations and just society in its uglier form, has that changed your perspective of humanity in any way?
As wild as this is, it actually has given me more empathy and understanding for people. When I was at Facebook, I did a lot of work interviewing former extremists, like sitting across a table from people who were in white supremacist communities, neo-Nazi communities, violent gangs. There were some, you know, violent Islamic extremists, people who had joined and left these extremist communities, and they were human beings. And it's sort of hard to imagine that someone like that also loves Hamilton, for example, but I would find out that they did. And also enjoyed eating bagels in New York City, but I would find out that they did. So I think that actually meeting those people and seeing the humanity that we shared has given me a lot of patience and empathy for people who carry viewpoints on issues that I just really find hateful. Because often there is a story behind how they ended up where they ended up and why they believe the things they believe.
Do you feel that there is or is not enough regulation on these social media platforms?
Yeah. So I worked with Twitter and I worked with Facebook on these exact issues. And I don't think there's enough regulation, but I also don't think that regulation is actually the answer. I don't know what the answer is, but the sort of complexity of these issues is much greater than any current elected official, I think, could possibly write legislation around. If you remember a few years ago, there was a hearing where elected officials were interviewing Mark Zuckerberg, and their understanding of just the basic business model, the basic platform, was so lacking. So I don't think the answer is quite regulation, but certainly oversight and there being accountability outside of just the shareholders is really, really important.
Well, how do you feel about freedom of speech if it then spreads into organizing hate and destruction?
I think there's definitely important limits. Right now, we see the way in which Twitter, it's called X now, I suppose, has changed and has evolved. And Elon Musk is someone who I think would identify himself as more of a free speech advocate. And Mark Zuckerberg, I think, is a bit more balanced. And I look at sort of the platforms and the difference between the kind of dialogue and discourse. And it's actually pretty significant, you know, but a lot of this stuff isn't about free speech or lack of free speech. Because technology and the design of technology has such an impact on the shape of conversations. So I can give you an example of what I mean. So, you know, Yelp, the kind of restaurant search engine thing. Yeah. So if you go to review a restaurant on Yelp and you have an intention in your head of giving it 5 stars, if you go and you look at the Yelp reviews and you see their average is 3 stars, you're actually likely to give it 4 stars instead of 5 stars, because we have this deep psychological desire to belong. And one sort of way of belonging subconsciously is to be more like the group, more sort of in the in-group, more like the norm. Similarly, if you intend to give it a bad rating, but you see it has a high rating, you're going to give it a slightly higher rating. Okay, so that's sort of an interesting learning. You look at a platform like Facebook, and the way that other people react to something that you might see on Facebook has a huge impact on how you're going to react, whether you recognize it or not. So for instance, if there is a post that shows an image of something and the first 3 comments that you see are really hateful, you're more likely to sort of mirror that same language. So you're going to respond in a way that's a little bit more hateful. Similarly, if the first 3 comments that you see are a bit more civil and understanding, you're more likely to have a more civil and a kind of understanding response. These are design decisions. If there's a post and there's 1,000 comments, Facebook's algorithm has to decide what are those 3 comments that you're going to see first. And we know that it has this sort of subtle impact in the overall shape of the conversation. So these are the kind of things that actually have nothing to do with regulation and have nothing to do with free speech, but are really about technology design and understanding human psychology and human behavior and how these things overlap. Because we found at Facebook, for instance, that if the first 3 comments that we previewed were more civil, that the rest of the conversation would be a lot more civil.
So we are, no matter how much we feel we are leaders or we are cutting our own path, we are still very influenced by what others are doing and saying.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
For all of humanity, we have been organizing ourselves into groups, and we want so desperately to feel like we're part of an in-group. And sometimes the easiest way to do that is to define an out-group as your opponent. It is the most human animalistic element of our existence, I think.
Well, I find it interesting that you are in a field that is loosely related to psychology, because you have to analyze, you know, the actions and behaviors of others in so many ways. Uh-huh. I know that your mother is a psychologist. Mm. And for those of you out there, I've known Lisa since she was probably 3 or 4 years old. I met her mother, who was a neighbor in my neighborhood in Laguna Beach, basically just knocked on their door one day trick-or-treating with 2 of my own children, and Rita brought her 2 kids down, and that was the end of that. We all became friends. That was the beginning and continuing friendship that's growing here. So I wanted to ask you also, when do you feel you became the person you are today?
Yesterday. I feel like I change every day a little bit. Maybe I was born this way in certain aspects of my life, but I feel like I'm always changing and growing and evolving. This latest kind of iteration of myself has certainly happened when I became a mother. I didn't expect it to change me so much, but it did. But how could it not? I think going to NYU changed me. Going to MIT for grad school changed me. Meeting my husband changed me. I think that part of being human is evolving and changing and growing. And I imagine that the person I'll be in 5 years will also be a little bit different.
So you keep becoming, which yeah. is a beautiful thing. It's great not to grow stagnant out there in the world. As the world evolves, we need to evolve too.
Yes, I agree.
I was also curious about your work. Your work uh-huh. has been at the intersection of technology and politics. Uh-huh. The early conversations around the internet and social media was that they were the future of democracy. Mm. Now the conversation about tech has led to the polarization and disinformation. Yeah. Do you still believe that digital innovation in politics can strengthen democracy?
I believe that it can, but I don't believe that it always does. And I think that it's interesting, but something you said a moment ago is that the world changes and so should we. My approach to my career has been very closely tied to how the world is changing. And as we as a society have learned more, I've evolved. So when I started my career, I was doing politics, pure politics, you know, campaigns, issue advocacy. I did the Obama campaigns. I did a local race in Los Angeles. I worked on immigration reform. And I sort of had this belief that if you elect good people, good things will happen. And then I learned that that wasn't always the case. And so I started to help organize people for issue advocacy. But it was always working within the system and using technology as a tool to aid political advocacy and political change. And in 2015, I was at the MIT Media Lab, which is this great research lab out of MIT, obviously. And we were working on this project with Twitter. We had access to the full Twitter fire hose, so every tweet ever published. And my lab was full of machine learning experts. We all now know about AI. So a lot of like AI, you know, data scientists. And our initial aspiration was to analyze Twitter data about the 2016 presidential election in a way that would kind of help elected officials and help the media report out on the issues that the public cared about. It was all about sort of policy issues. So we wanted to know what issues are most important to the electorate because we thought that that might have real world beneficial impacts on our democracy. Now, the really interesting thing was when we were looking at this data, the data wasn't making sense. We were unable to find really clear patterns until one day we decided to isolate by political party and by candidate that the public supported. And so once we isolated the people that supported Donald Trump and the people that supported Hillary Clinton and the people that supported Bernie Sanders, only then were we able to find patterns in the data. What those patterns showed was that the greatest predictor of the issues you care about and even the facts that you believe are true and the events that you even think happened and matter was which candidate you supported. And so I, 2015, 2016, became everything that I had done prior to that was about advocating for certain policies and candidates. I sort of threw all that away and I became obsessed with how do we solve this problem of division? Because how can we possibly govern and cooperate as a society in politics or outside of politics if our sense of reality is so distorted via the sort of lens of the candidate or the party that you're part of? And we happened to be one of the first labs in the world that was finding these results. And now we all understand that social media and technology have exacerbated political polarization and polarization in general. But I was, you know, in a research lab studying this as it was unfolding. And that has completely shifted the trajectory of my, I call it my career, but I'm someone who has a very purposeful career. So my purpose, my calling, my work, my effort, it's so much more than career.
Wow. So you went from NYU, New York University.
Yeah.
And you end up at MIT. And for those listeners that may not be aware, that is
Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
And that was for your master's?
Yeah. I was in the business school, and MIT has a great program focused on technology and entrepreneurship. I didn't actually expect to become an entrepreneur, but I have since done that. And while I was getting my graduate degree, my MBA at MIT, I was also working down the street at the MIT Media Lab. The Media Lab is really unique because it brings together a lot of different disciplines. And I'd come from politics, and that was a lens that I brought to the work. But most of the other folks in the research lab were data scientists.
And at this point, is this when you are selected as a Forbes magazine 30 under 30?
It was right after this. We became one of the first labs looking at this. And so I did a lot of talks. It was a really cool experience. We prepped the moderators of the presidential debates. We did all these partnerships with, you know, newspapers and magazines and wrote a lot of articles about our research. Later on, our lab was on the cover of Science magazine with this really incredible report about misinformation on Twitter. Then I joined Facebook to help lead Facebook's work on reducing polarization and extremism. And it was when I was at Facebook that I got the Forbes 30 under 30 recognition. I sadly am no longer under 30.
Would you mind sharing what exactly Forbes 30 under 30 is?
Yeah. So it is a Forbes magazine. One of the things that they do is they put lists together to kind of honor different kinds of people. They have a variety of different sorts of lists. And one of the lists from the last, I think it probably started 10 years ago, maybe even longer, is to recognize 30 people who are doing important work in some form under the age of 30, which I find now that I'm over the age of 30, I think that we as a society put too much pressure on people under 30 to do big things when actually there's great value in working hard and learning from people with more experience. But that aside, it is a really big honor and it's a wonderful community to be part of. And I was very fortunate to be included on the list for 2018.
Well, bravo. And now that you are a new mother and your daughter is just 13 months old, How do you manage that time in balancing a full-time career and a full-time child?
It's really, really challenging. There's the logistics and then there's the emotions of it. So there's a few things. My husband and I really try to have as equal of a partnership as is possible. And both of us are entrepreneurial. I'm the co-founder and CEO of my own company. He's a venture capitalist, managing partner of his own fund. We also both have chosen to work remotely. And all of our, my employees, his employees also get to work remotely. And so we're both home. We have a nanny who is incredible and comes every day to hang out with and help stimulate and shape our wonderful daughter. You know, the schedule is we got to be efficient. And every day balancing work and keeping our house clean and taking care of ourselves and spending time with Gigi, it's a lot and it's challenging. I think for me, and I think this is true for moms who don't work, every night I sort of grieve that day in this odd way because she changes so much every day. She looks different. She evolves. She's doing different things. And I just know the time goes by so, so quickly. And I just feel sad that that day is over and that the next day she'll be older and different and changing. So it's really challenging. I try to learn. I always think about all the things I'm responsible for as like balls in the air. And I just have to learn which balls are glass that I can't drop because they'll break into a million pieces, and which are plastic and can fall on the floor no problem, and which are rubber where when they fall, we'll just bounce right back up and I'll catch them again. It's a constant exercise in prioritization and efficiency.
Do you feel that you lose any of the nuance or that chemistry when you're actually working remotely with the people, or is it missing anything to you?
So this is exactly as kind of a meta point what my company Gather Round is trying to solve. We are both fully remote ourselves and also our product and what we sell to other companies that are remote and hybrid. And the main thing that we help them with is connection, helping to create connection and belonging and understanding between members of a remote or distributed team. So it's definitely a challenge, but we, I think, are probably better than most at it.
Nice. To get that human connection, you know, I feel it with you right now. We're doing this interview remotely.
Yeah.
I know that there's a certain chemistry that I feel is a little bit off to the side when I'm virtual. But let's face it, it helped us all through the pandemic. That's for
totally.
Sure. So thank you for keeping that up. And I'm sure it makes corporations much happier when they can just pull people from around the world together on one of these conferencing platforms. So thank you for Gather Round. And I can ask you, but I'm pretty sure I know, who was your biggest role model when growing up?
I've had so many. Definitely my mom and my dad. And their parents also, for different reasons and in different ways. Yeah, my mom and my dad, they have the best marriage and they're so in love. And they, at this point, are so similar to each other in certain ways, but they're also kind of yin and yang, which I think makes them work and also has shaped me. My dad is very organized, very clean, very rational. My mom is just a creative powerhouse who's all warmth and love and big ideas. Of course, my mom also can be very organized and rational, and she needs to be. And my dad also is very creative. They've kind of brought that out in each other. But I think I'm really such a combination of both of them. And that, I think, is one of my superpowers. So they're both very much, I would say, each of them individually, and then the two of them together as a unit are my role models.
How do you feel, or do you feel anything, about the political landscape in America today?
Yeah. I think, a healthy mix of concern and hope. I think my head feels a lot of concern, but my heart feels a lot of hope because I have a 13-month-old daughter, and I just refuse to believe that she won't live in a world that's good and better. And I do find young people really inspiring. I know I'm still a young person, but there's now people even younger, different generation.
I know. Can you believe it? It happens.
I know. I don't know. I don't know how that happened. I work with a lot of Gen Z people, and they're so cool. Like, they really refuse to settle. They care about the world. They're passionate about climate change and justice and social issues. And so when I look at the world right now and our political landscape right now, ooh, makes me scared and sad and kind of nauseous. But when I look at what inevitably it will have to get better, and the next generation and the generations after that, I have to think and hope that they'll help.
And so when you think about these things that ail you, what specifically are they that you're concerned about in our country today?
There are a number of policy issues that I care about, but the bigger thing that concerns me is the same issue that I've been trying to solve for the last however many years, 7 years, which is political extremism and polarization. Because if we don't agree on some core realities, we can never cooperate. The metaphor that I always think about is like a sports game. You know, if there was a football game, I know you like this one team, I like the other team, and we can agree that there was a game last night, we can agree that your team won and my team lost, we can agree what the score was, I can have empathy that you're happy, you can have empathy that I'm sad. If we can sort of agree on those basic realities, we can at least disagree and still care about each other as human beings and move forward. We are living in this world right now where, depending on the team we're on, we don't even agree there was a game last night, let alone what the score was and who won, or having empathy for each other. There are these sort of layers of truth, I suppose, that is not present today. And so beyond any party or any candidate or any policy issue, I'm so concerned about societal division and the lack of ability to even begin to cooperate or have empathy for other people. And that terrifies me.
Well, I find it interesting that we're very much on the same page here. I was getting irate and arguing, not having, you know, reasonable conversations, but arguing with people about our different perspectives. And this didn't really exist prior to, I'd say, 2016 in my world.
Yeah.
I would just agree to disagree and be happy for people to have their own perspectives. Mm-hmm. And creating Debracratic was really to unify.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people come and share their hearts and their souls with us here. And maybe we can find more unity than division that we feel we have going on right now.
It sounds like you have this understanding of this instinct around what you're doing. I'll just share some academic framing as to why Debracratic is so important and what you're doing. So when we think about the word polarization, it's sort of defined as extremism on either end, right? And there are two kinds of polarization. There's issue polarization and affective polarization. So issue polarization refers to the issues that we feel polarized about. So maybe you're pro-life, I'm pro-choice, for example. You're not, but you know. But affective polarization refers to the way that we feel towards those people who disagree with us. So you and I could disagree on a TV show or a policy issue without hating each other. And what's happened over the last decade or so is that people hate the human being who holds the belief that they disagree with. What do you do about that? How do you address that? It's through storytelling. It's through understanding what makes us humans, what we have in common, even if the things we have in common have nothing to do with the issues that we disagree on. And this is not to say we should all kumbaya, agree on everything. America is full of argument and disagreement, and that's democracy. But we don't have to hate the person who disagrees with us. And so what you're doing here, telling people stories, is exactly right, because it reduces this thing called affective polarization and the way we feel towards those who we don't agree with.
Well, thank you for breaking that down for me. I just really love to hear people's stories, and I want to show the beauty in all of us, even if we do have differing views and opinions. It feels like hatred sometimes is a more powerful emotion than love, because people are drawn into that almost more than they're drawn into love and unity.
Mm.
And I think we got to get back to some balance and normalcy. And I'm a little concerned when people can't get real truth through what should have been factual news, not alternative facts. How can we get back to civility when we can't even get truth told to us?
It's so interesting. I think about the word trust in media. You know, if you don't think about it for too long, you just assume truth and trust are kind of the same thing, because that used to be true. You would start to trust a source because time and time again, the thing they were reporting turned out to be true. But what's happened over the last decade or so is that trust grows when the source says things that you like. So it's not about it being true. It's about if you agree with it and it feels good to you. That's how trust grows.
Right. And it brings us back to just fake news going out there and misinformation, disinformation, misinforming the public. It's a very scary thing. And I'm hoping that it doesn't snowball with AI.
Yeah.
Because now you can put the visual with, you know, with the text. You're not just reading it. You're actually seeing things that can be contrived and used to propagate.
Yeah.
But let's talk about something much more optimistic and uplifting. What makes you happy today about our beautiful country?
I mean, the thing that makes me really happy, honestly, is my daughter. I'll give you just a little example. So she started walking about 2 weeks ago.
And there's Gigi in the background.
I know, sorry.
This is a working mom.
Watching her learn to walk was so inspiring. She kind of realized she could sort of do it. She would take a few steps and then she would just fall on her butt. And most babies, when they fall, might cry. But what she would do was start applauding herself. So she would take a few steps, fall, and then clap. The big smile on her face. The next night, a few more steps, fall, clap. And then finally, a few days later, she was able to take 8 or 9 steps, fall in a more graceful way, and she still would clap. And so there's something really beautiful about that, the idea of making mistakes and but trying and celebrating yourself and celebrating the journey and celebrating the learning. And I just think that our world will be a lot better if more people operate, taking risks, taking chances, trying to get better, unafraid of learning, unafraid of growing, and celebrating the journey, celebrating the process. And I have to think that kind of the Project of America can learn a thing or two from that way of operating.
Bravo. That's beautiful. And I know that you are so busy being a mom and with your career and coming from a mother yourself who is an activist. I mean, she fought to stop a large parking structure from being built on the farmer's market in Laguna Beach. She also fought and maybe is still fighting to get the spent nuclear rods moved from San Onofre nuclear plant. And I wanted to also bring up your father and the fact that your father is a pancreatic cancer survivor. Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. And when that came to be that the family found out dad had pancreatic cancer, where were you in this journey? At which point in life were you at?
Okay, so I, prior to having my daughter Gigi, had a pregnancy prior to my pregnancy with her that we had to terminate for medical reasons when I was 22 weeks pregnant, which was just horrible. So I had found out that I was pregnant about 2 or 3 weeks before he was diagnosed. And it was really weird, that whole experience, because I would be going in for my scans while he was going in for his scans. And he was starting chemo and feeling really nauseous. And I was in my first trimester and feeling really nauseous. It was like we were so connected in this really weird way. And he then had surgery to remove the tumor. And I think it was the day after his surgery to remove the tumor that I had the sedatomy scan that revealed that there was something really wrong with the baby and that the baby was never going to be born and that most likely if the pregnancy continued, my life would be in danger, which is a longer conversation. And so what was really weird about the whole thing was the timing, because he had the surgery, it was cancer-free, and the day that he was wheeled out of the hospital without the tumor, I was being wheeled into the operating room to terminate the pregnancy. And I was recovering from that while he was recovering. And so life is just funny. And it was awful in all the ways, every way imaginable. Anyone listening can imagine being any of us in that situation, how terrible it would be. But sometimes in some ways, it's given me like a little bit of peace that that baby, that soul was maybe just there temporarily to keep me eating and to keep me sane while my dad was sick. And that as soon as it was clear that he was going to survive, that soul didn't need to be there anymore. I think I'll never really understand that time because it was so much.
I know. And I can see just in your face looking at you and hear it in your voice, how difficult and how heartbreaking a decision it was for you to make to terminate that pregnancy.
It was awful. Yeah.
And your own life was in jeopardy.
Yeah.
So obviously that takes me to the conversation of Roe v. Wade being overturned. How do you rationalize that when there are people out there potentially in the same situation as you?
I mean, I have to think people just don't understand. There is no way that you could hear my story, be in the room with my doctors, and not allow. It's not even a decision. How is this even a policy issue? This was a medical situation. I was in an operating room with lots of doctors and anesthesiologists and nurses. Like, what on earth does that have to do with our Supreme Court? What does that have to do with our elected officials? I have to think that people making these decisions just don't understand, because the reality is I was, 20 weeks pregnant with my husband, very much wanting a baby, devastated to find out that the baby had all sorts of problems and that there's something called mirror syndrome, where the baby's heart was going to fail and then that would make my heart fail. Who on earth would not be okay? I mean, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. I just don't know how we're in this position where that's not legal.
I mean, honestly, pro-life, whose life?
Right.
Whose life? Is your life not worth saving?
Right.
And thank you for sharing that, because it's really, I've heard a lot lately, people use abortion for birth control.
Mm-mm.
Oh, people use it because they screwed up or putting it on the person. Well, no, I knew a very religious couple who in the eighth month of the pregnancy found that child, and these were devout Christians, they believed that child, through their doctor, would have no quality of life, nor would that marriage survive the traumas and trials that having a child in that condition would bring upon them. And they got dispensation from their pastor or priest, and they were allowed to terminate the pregnancy for the betterment of the whole family. And today, they are staunch anti-abortion people. Such hypocrisy. So I think it's really, really great of you to share that personal story for those out there who are struggling with these situations. And I'm so sorry that you had to go through that and make that very difficult decision.
Thank you.
And I'm just so happy that you have Gigi now.
I know.
And she's so uplifting and so beautiful. And I want to tell you that this has been such an honor and a privilege to speak with you. And thank you for taking the time today to share some of your phenomenal story. And I'm optimistic about the future because of people like you and because of children like your daughter. So thank you for the time you gave us today. I love you.
Thank you. I love you. Thank you for this.
This episode of Deborah Craddock was hosted by me, Deborah Drucker. It was produced by Lee Rocker, with co-production and editing by Gideon Brower. Our amazing music was performed by Amy Nelson and Kathy Guthrie of Folk Uke. Be sure to rate and review this episode wherever you listen to podcasts. For more Deborah Craddock, check out deborahcraddock.com and our Instagram at Deborah Craddock. That's D-E-B-O-R-A-H Craddock, like Democratic. Until next time.